course, Wednesday night. But the speech that we concluded last Sunday morning of Bildad marked an end to an exchange between Job and the friends. There's still a lot more talking to do. Job will have a lot to say. And then, of course, there's the character Elihu, who we have not gotten to yet, but he will have something to say. And then, of course, the last spokesman in this exchange is who? God will speak. And we've not gotten to that yet either. But as we come to these chapters, when at the end of chapter 25, which you see is very short, only six verses, that concludes the speeches, the collective speeches of the three friends who came to Job at the end of chapter 2. And that's been quite a while ago as we've gone through all this material. So these words of Bildad's argument that we went through last Sunday, and if you read any commentaries or any words of writers, of course we can't prove this from the Bible, but I think it's plausible to think about it. The shortness of Bildad's speech, very, very short, and the absence of Zophar speaking for a third time have led many to conclude that they just eventually gave up. And no use in going on with this. Job's not going to change his mind. We can't convince him. They didn't have anything new to say every time, so they just kind of quit, if you will. And so Bildad didn't add anything new. He seems to be talking about that Job has persistently requested this meeting with God. And in these short verses, he lauds God's high, majestic presence. Job, this meeting you want with God, God's too great for such a meeting. You can't gain such an audience. And then verses 4 through 6, man's really too pitiful, too weak, too insignificant to have such a meeting. So that seems to be what Bildad was addressing on the part of Job. And then we got to Job's response. And initially, he's very terse, very sarcastic toward Bildad and the others. Rejects what Bildad was saying as it applied to him, but he's done that before also. That's nothing new for Job to have said that. And then this is where we left off. Verses 5 through 14, Job offers his own view, if you will, his own observations about God's greatness. And that takes us pretty much through the whole chapter, verses 5 through 14. And I want us to read all those verses together in one setting, because they do go together. There's not really a good way to break those apart in the sense of this section goes with this topic and this section goes with that topic. So let's consider them all together. All right? This is Job 26 now, starting in verse 5. Matt Davis, would you read those 10 verses for us, please?
The dead tremble, those under the waters and those inhabiting them. Sheol is naked before him, and destruction has no covering. He stretches out the north over empty space. Hangs the earth on nothing. He binds up the water in his thick clouds, and yet the clouds are not broken. He covered his face with throne, spread the fire. He drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters, a boundary of light and darkness. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astonished at their beauty. He stirs up the sea with his power and by his understanding he breaks up the storm.
All right, if you were to try to characterize some of the main thoughts of this speech, what about God does Job seem to be emphasizing? If you were to try to classify him in some way, what does he talk about? All right, his power, especially in what realm? Nature, yeah. His control over the forces of nature. Such majestic speaking, stretches out the north over empty space, hangs the earth on nothing. We don't want to poke fun at people, but there have been several paradigms throughout the centuries where men have wondered, well, what does the earth set on? And they've conjectured things like, well, there's this man named Atlas, he holds the world up. And some have thought, there's this big giant turtle. And we don't want to laugh at anybody, but that's really what people have thought through the centuries. What's the Bible say? What's God done? It's just hanging out there. And He keeps that by His power, His majestic power. Job understood that centuries ago. Wraps the water up in the clouds. But yet, at the end of verse 8, he stores so much water up in the clouds, yet what doesn't happen? It doesn't come out. It doesn't burst under the weight of all that collecting of water. Why does it do that? How can it do that? Only one reason. God controls that. He's in charge, in complete control of that natural process. quiets the sea with His power. Of course, not just the Father, but who else in the Bible has done that? The Son did that, didn't He? Peace be still. And that tempest was immediately calmed. By His breath, the heavens are declared. Pardon me, my voice is... the end of verse 14, but His mighty thunder, who can understand? So Job shows an understanding about the power of God that the friends have not spoken about. That's why I said last week, when we looked at these... Job's understanding in this area, to me, seemed to be very superior to them. I'm not calling them dunces. I'm just saying, based on the things that they have said in their previous speeches, Job's grounding in this area, he shows a depth of understanding about the power and the nature of God that if the friends knew it, they didn't express it. I don't know what they knew. All I know is what they said. And based on what they said, I think their information on this is inferior to Job's.
I have something to do with the fact that God says, my servant Job. Not only did God know Job, but Job knew God.
Yes, I think that's a good thing to say. Job did know God. Perhaps in a very profound way that these three friends did not know Him. Job's a wise man. And he suffered. Yes, Harold. What verse are you reading from, Harold?
25, verse 4.
Great. Chapter 25, verse 4, Harold's reading from. Yes.
Now, but he acknowledges that he is God.
Yes. Yes. No one has ever denied that there's not a God. It's just that the view of God is distinctly different between the friends' arguments collectively and how Job perceives God in his responses to the friends. So that's a good observation to make. So I think we have a lack of understanding on the part of the friends toward God versus what Job saw about it. Just to summarize these things, look how Job, he talks about God's majestic power. Notice the extremes in the speech. From the depths of Sheol, he talked about Sheol and the realm of the dead, the realm of departed spirits, from as low as that is to the heights of the heavens. Job understood the breadth, the difference, the range, if you will, of God's power. He also talked about how God controls the living. He controls the dead. He controls the realm of the forces of nature. There's no area of existence of life that Jehovah, the Almighty, does not control. And Job mentions that in this speech. Yes, He's omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent. He's all those things. The all-seeing, all-knowing, all-powerful God. So these are Job's observations through this short speech in chapter 26 as he responds to Bildad more directly, but not just to him, but to all the friends that they've been making their case throughout the book. So this was pretty much what I want to talk about through the end of page 20, which is questions 3 and 4. It takes us through the end of chapter 26. Anybody have a comment or a question? Yes, buddy.
What these three friends rest to know, what these three friends would have done if they'd have really known the situation with Job, would have been over there praising him and encouraging him just like this every day?
That's a good question. If they had known, let's apply that to us. What if in our dealings with each other, what if we knew the reason behind the way some things happen, which we don't at times, would we act the way we have in the past? Probably not. We probably could do better. We probably would do better. So that's something that's worthy to think about also. But as we've been saying, we don't want to be just boringly redundant. But again, no one in this whole situation knew of the reason behind all this, of that earlier conversation between Jehovah and Satan. The friends didn't know it. Job didn't know it. And so everyone is acting on assumptions. And that, of course, is always dangerous ground to walk on. Okay. Now, let's make a pause here. And we're going to put it on the charts. The exchange really is over. There'll be no more debating back and forth between Job and the friends. That is through. The friends have not convicted Job of sin. They couldn't convict him with evidence, even though at one time Eliphaz, did he not get specific? Job, you've done this, and Job, you've done that. But it wasn't true. So they couldn't convict Job, nor could they convince Job himself that he had done wrong. Job dug his heels in, didn't he? He never copped to it. He never said, you're right. He held fast to his integrity. He held fast to his integrity. So they couldn't convince Job of his sin, and they failed to answer his dilemma. And just for review purposes again, what is Job's dilemma in his own mind? What's his dilemma? Why am I in the state that I'm in? And has Job thought about it? Because I know what? I haven't sinned. I don't deserve this treatment. So Job was making assumptions also, connecting righteousness and or sinful living with human suffering. He made that connection too. Not in the same way the friends did, but he did connect them. So they couldn't answer his dilemma. And now Job will speak alone. We, in chapters 27 through 31, these next five chapters, it's just Job giving a soliloquy, if you will, or just another lament about this thing or that. Further, just speaking out of the grief of his situation. Oh, yes. Yes. That's correct. Job still is. He's not only has he not been convinced by the friends, but Job is still not convinced that this is not God responsible for all this. And he has made numerous statements through the chapters, speaking what I will say. These are my words, speaking ill of the Almighty, attributing all this to God, blaming God, if you will, that he has brought all this on him. Unfair criticisms. OK, let's look now at Job's final discourse. 27 verse 1 through 31 and verse 40. And this takes us now to the top of page 21. Chapter 27. Job remains very resolved in his own defense. He's very firm about that. And just to... Wayne gave us a good lead in there. Look at 27 as we begin. As God lives... This is verse 2. As God lives, who has taken away my right? And the Almighty who has embittered my soul. That reminds me of another Bible character when Naomi came back with Ruth. Remember that? And everybody said, I'm paraphrasing. Well, look, there's Naomi. She said, don't call me Naomi, but rather call me Mara, which means bitter, because the Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord's brought me back bitter. See, she kind of blamed God about that too. So, people in the Bible at times have done that for their pitiful situations that they have found themselves in. So Job once again makes such a statement. Verse 3, for as long as life is in me and the breath of God is in my nostrils, my lips will certainly not speak unjustly. Well, I'm not so sure about that. I think he has. Nor will my tongue mutter deceit. Far be it from me that I should declare you, and that would be not God, but the friends. I will declare you right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach any of my days. So, Job refuses to concede the argument to the friends, I'm not going to agree with you, and I will continue to speak out. I'm not going to be quiet about this. I'm going to keep saying what I think and feel needs to be said in my own defense. So that's 1 through chapter 27, 1 through 6. Okay. Now let's look at verses 7 through 12. Job's going to show more wisdom. And again, it's time now that I think, as he sees it, he's going to instruct the friends. All right. Albert, would you read for us, please, verses 7 through 12 of chapter 27, please. What is the version you read from? Is that the New King James? Why do you behave in complete nonsense? That's good. I wasn't aware that it was worded that way at the end of verse 12. Mine says foolishly, but I like that one better. That's a rebuke to the friends. He's kind of summarizing their arguments. Now, you know what I'm saying. So then why have you said all these things that you have said up to now? It doesn't agree with what you know the truth to be about the Almighty, about Jehovah. You've talked nonsense. You've talked foolishly. That seems to be the end rebuke, if you will, of that particular section. Okay. Job properly understood the fate of the wicked. Did the friends properly understand the fate of the wicked, based on what we have seen from their speeches?
No, because they're thinking in terms of what physically things happen.
All right. Have the friends ever said that the wicked will not be judged by God? They said that the wicked would suffer judgment from God. Yes, they did. So they may have known about the fate, the end fate, the ultimate fate of the doom of the wicked. But they have said things about the wicked and God's dealing with them that have not been true. They have at least made that mistake. So Job, he properly understood their fate. He pronounces a curse upon his enemies, upon his opponent. Look in verse 7 again. May my enemy be as the wicked, and my opponent as the unjust. Well, now, let's consider the possibility. Who might Job be talking about here? His buddies? This may be a reference to his friends, because they have opposed him throughout this entire debate. I'm not entirely sure about that, but I'm open to that possibility. That could be who he's talking about.
It doesn't seem like it's non-direct. It seems like it is direct.
Yes, I think it's possible. How probable? I don't know. I don't want to be dogmatic about that.
Would this take in all?
Yes, it would. It would take in all the wicked, but he may have, in a more direct sense, applying it to the friends. That would be true either way.
Just like when they did, they talked in general terms, but you know they were talking.
Yes, that's exactly correct. Though they spoke in generalities, they did have Job in mind. That is correct. I think you're right about that. So, excuse me. He then talks about the godless man. And based on verse 8 and 9, the godless man won't do what with respect to God? I think your version said the hypocrite, right, Albert? In verse 8 and 9, it said hypocrite or godless, some versions say. They won't do what with God? Based on verses 8 and 9 of this chapter, the godless or the hypocrite man won't do what with respect to God, as the text says?
They won't be in a good relationship with God.
And they won't even call on Him, will they? Is that what it says? I mean, they're not living in harmony with Him. They don't have a relationship with Him, so why would they even think about calling on Him? Because, will God answer? Not usually. That's true. In the most absolute sense, you're right. He is cut off from God when he dies. Verse 10. Will such a one take delight in the Almighty? Well, no, he won't. He's living his life apart from God. He has no delight in God or the things of God. That doesn't interest him. He's not wanting any part of that kind of a life. So the godless has no right, no expectation for God to answer should he call. He's not even looking for that.
It's possible. Think about it. He's making statements that are true.
Who, Job at this point? Yes.
And he mentioned the fact that maybe he's talking about his friend, but he might also be talking about it from a rhetorical standpoint. Why would I be calling him God? Why would I be living the kind of life I am if I'm this kind of person?
I think that's a very good point. Bill is saying, this could be in his own defense because the friends have accused him, either implicitly or explicitly throughout the whole debate, that you're godless. You're guilty of some sin, Job. And Job's saying, if I were, would I be calling on God, which Job has been calling on God for answers to his questions. So he could be using rhetoric here to answer their insinuations and their unfounded charges. So, Job was just talking about the destiny, the fate of the wicked. The godless man takes no delight in the Almighty and will not call on Him. And then he says in verses 11 and 12, I think this is directly right at the friends, when he says, I will instruct you, you friends, you three, I will teach you about the power of God. What is with the Almighty I will not conceal. Behold, all of you have seen it. You know these things. You're not uninformed. These were wise old men who had been around. They weren't naive. So he says, why then do you act in complete nonsense? Or why do you act foolishly? There's no reason for you all to have said the things that you've said. No reason for you to think the way you've been thinking and have expressed yourself in this entire debate. So Job is getting right down to the quick with these guys. Yes, Trevor. That's a good observation. The world is full of people that really don't give God the time of day until what happens? I get in a bad scrape. Well, God, if you get me out of this, then I promise I'll do such and so thing. And, I mean, a lot of folks behave that way. So Job shows himself to be a man who tries to have a continual relationship with God, one that's always abiding, ever constant, not just when he's in trouble. Yes, Brother. I shouldn't laugh at that. That's really kind of sad, isn't it?
That's right. The way people do that.
Yes, people do that way. They make these promises to God, and then times get better, and then they've got no intention of going through on their promise, if you will. Okay. Now we get to verses 13 through 23, and Job is again. He's continuing to show us his understanding, if you will, of the portion of the wicked man from God and his inheritance. Verses 13 through, this takes us through the end of the chapter. Verse 13. This is the portion of a wicked man from God, and the inheritance which tyrants receive from the Almighty. Though his sons are many, they are destined for the sword, and his descendants will not be satisfied with bread. His survivors will be buried because of the plague, and their widows will not be able to weep. Though he piles up silver like dust and prepares garments as plentiful as the clay, he may prepare it, but the just will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. He has built his house like the spider's web, or as a hut which the watchman has made. He lies down rich, but never again. He opens his eyes, and it is no more. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. The east wind carries him away, and he is gone. for it whirls him away from his place. For it will hurl at him without sparing. He will surely try to flee from its power. Men will clap their hands at him and will hiss him from his place. I want to pay particular attention to two verses, verses 14 and 16, just real quickly. Again, I think we see Job showing the emptiness, if you will, of previous arguments on the part of the friends. Hold your place right here and turn back to chapter 18 just for a moment and look at verse 19. I think Job is comparing previous words of the friends. Chapter 18, Bildad is speaking. We've looked at these before, but I want to go over them again real quickly. What did Bildad say about the offspring or the descendants of the wicked man? Based on that one verse alone. Rob, what does he say?
He has neither time nor posterity among the people, nor any remaining in his dwelling.
He's got no offspring, no survivors. Chapter 27, verse 14. And 15. What's Job say? Well, he's got offspring. He's got survivors. See, the friends had said, a wicked man, God will see to it. He's got no survivors. And by the way, again, where's Job's descendants? They're gone. So what are they saying by insinuation? He's a wicked man. Job answers that again. See, they made assumptions. Just because a man is wicked doesn't mean just because of his wickedness he will lose every descendant he's ever going to have. No, God doesn't work that way. That's the way in their world, that's how God works. But that's not how the Almighty has acted on behalf of men throughout the ages. Look at verse 16 of chapter 27. Job says about the wicked man, though he piles up silver like dust, and prepares garments as plentiful as the clay. Now go back to chapter 20 and look at verse 15. This is Zophar speaking. The wicked man, Zophar says, if he swallows up riches. Now this is all metaphors. I'll take it literally. If you just swallow up riches, what's going to happen? He's going to vomit them up. The end of verse 15. Zophar says, who's behind that? God will expel them from his belly. God will not let the wicked man prosper. Now that's their view of God. God will not let the man prosper, gain from his wickedness. Yet what does Job say in this speech? What can the wicked man do? He can pile up like the dust of the... Is that true? Well, sure. The world is full of rich people who are wicked to the core. Absolutely. So again, I think Job is exposing the shallowness of some of their previously stated arguments. And again, that's why I'm saying, in this speech, if you will, in this last discourse of Job, he shows an understanding, a wisdom that is superior to that of the friends. He has an insight into this stuff that these men, it's not that they were unable to have, they just chose not to think that way. That's just, they're holding to their theology, if you will. That's just the way things are in our world, in our mind, and that's just how it is. And Job is exposing some of that in these final speeches of his. Okay, so Job says, you know, even though the wicked man may have many sons, they are destined for the sword. They perish. Is that generally true? Yes, they do. If they continue on in that kind of lifestyle, more times than not, that leads to what result? Destruction. They'll perish because of their activities. That is true. What did Jesus say in the garden when Peter drew the sword? You live by the sword, you're going to perish by the sword. Now that's what the Lord said, and that's usually true. Verse 15. Other calamities, the plague, pestilence, will affect his survivors. In the Bible, who has been one to send plague and pestilence? God did he not? And for what reason? Punishment for wickedness. That's true. That has happened many times over and over. We have seen that. All right. Job also says that, and we looked at this verse already, all the wealth he piles up will outlive him and eventually give him to who? That's right. And the book of Ecclesiastes has much to say about that same point as well. Speaking about materialism. Was somebody going to make a comment? Yes. Yes. Matthew 5. Jesus said, God gives both the sunshine and the rain to the righteous and the unrighteous. He's indiscriminate in those blessings. All mankind enjoy those. That is true. And all he builds for himself will not sustain him in the end. He cannot avoid the doom that awaits him. Verse 18, he builds his house like a spider's web. My version says, that's verse 18, or a moth. Very rickety. No support. Such a man is leaning on things that aren't as eternal as who? As he is. And that's a mistake to make. That's why materialism is such a threat to man. Because man puts all his... He deposits all of his trust in things that are not as material as, or that aren't as eternal as he is. It's like leaning on a spider web. It's not going to hold you up in the end. You're doomed for failure. You're doomed for destruction. Yes, Harold. Well, that's true. That's true. That is correct. They did not meet their end in the sense of having lost their life. Yes. Right. Jesus said, fear not him who can destroy the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell. Matthew 10:28. That is correct. That's a good observation to make. Okay. He's taken away by forces he can't control. Job mentions in these verses here, especially starting in verse 20, terrors overtake him like a flood. Tempest steals him away. East wind carries him away. He is gone. Whirls him away from his place. It hurls him without sparing. The men who involve themselves in activities eventually that are wicked and are at naught with God and His will, eventually they are carried away. Are they not? And they can't stop the process. Once that ball gets rolling downhill, you can't stop it. It's kind of like trying to hold back the tide with your hands like this. It won't work. And oftentimes, man's wickedness brings about consequences that he cannot change or alter. And they carry him away. And Job says that here. And not only that, what happens at the end? Look at verse 23. Now, my version says, men will clap their hands at him. What does other versions say? Is it something similar? Why would there be any clapping going on? He's gone. That's right. He's gone. And this last statement, they will hiss him from his place. Hissing in the Bible was an expression of what? Disgust. When the men came by, was there not some hissing going on at the cross toward Christ? Well, yes, but that was something that they did. They would come by, they would wag their heads, they would mock him, they would spit, they would hiss. Those were all expressions of disgust. They were glad to see this happening. And Job says, with respect, when the wicked man is gone, there'll be those that are having a party over the fact that he's gone. They'll be glad to see it. All right? So Job expressed all this. And what we need to understand is that Job, in this speech, protests that he is such a man. This isn't the kind of man I am. The friends have been saying all along, Job, this is who you are. God has brought all this on you because you've got some great big old sin in your closet. And you've got to get it out of there and you've got to repent. And Job is now saying, boy, he's been protesting all along, but he's even more emphatically saying now, I am not such a man. And anyone who opposes me in this, his claims of innocence, he says, is my enemy. Again, we go back to how this begins in 27. May my enemy be as the wicked, and may my opponent as the unjust. And then Job describes him. So we just asked the question, could Job be referring to the friends? I think it's very, very possible. Maybe even very likely. But he's talking about, as Harold said a moment ago, this could be a broad indictment against all wicked, and I think that would certainly be true. But Job may also be referring directly to these three, who have been his opponent in this debate the whole time, and have mischaracterized him in their statements that they've made. So Job, again, is standing on his character. He's standing on his integrity. He's dug his heels in, and he's not going to give in to what they've been saying. Okay. Now, before we get to some of the points in chapter 28, I want you to go back to chapter 17 just for a moment. And it's verse 9 that I want to look at there. Chapter 17 and verse 9. This was one of the bright spots in the previous speech of Job. And I've said this numerous times, and I hope I'm not just being so repetitive that it's not tolerable. But I really think it's proper to view the speeches of Job in this book as a roller coaster. It's up and it's down. It's up and it's down. He's going through this journey. This was one of those high points in an early speech of Job. He had said some things that were not true and said some things that were not wise with respect to how he viewed God and all this. But look in, let's start in verse 6 of chapter 17. These are some of the bad things about God. He says, "He has made me a byword of the people. I am one at whom men spit." He laid that at God's feet. Blame God for that. "My eye has also grown dim because of grief. All my members are as a shadow. The upright shall be appalled at this, and the innocent shall stir himself up against the godless." That's how men are responding, reacting to me. Now look at verse 9. "Nevertheless, or yet, or despite what I just said," what about the righteous man? What's he say in verse 9? "He shall hold to his way." That's what Job is going to do, and that's what he's done. "And he who has clean hands," what's going to happen? He's going to grow stronger. Now, we jump all the way up to where we are now. We leapfrog a lot of stuff between that spot and right now. Do you see a stronger Job? I do. I see a stronger Job. Job is stronger for having gone through this. Yes, he did some things. He said some things that I think were not wise. But to me, this is really, really important. This is the reason why we have the book of Job. It's not just to study about an ancient man and say, "Well, isn't that interesting what happened to Job?" No, we have to learn from it. When you and I go through situations that may not last a week, they may last for months, they may last for years. I think the length of time really is irrelevant. The point is, what do we do with that experience? Hopefully, it makes us stronger. Job is now showing, especially at the latter part of these speeches in this part of the book, I see Job really coming on strong now, really coming on fast. And he's growing in his intellect. He's growing in his perception of how he sees things. He's growing stronger in his approach to this situation. I think Job at this point has a better understanding on it now than he did when it began. I know that's so in chapter 42, when it all comes full circle. And he says to God, I repent and I retract in ashes. I spoke things that I did not know anything about. And he's wiser for that. So what I want to end today's class with is when we get to talking about these kinds of points here, Job is now illustrating this truth that he said back in chapter 17. The righteous will hold his integrity. And he with clean hands is going to grow stronger in the midst of such trials and ordeals. He's progressing in character. despite this ordeal that has vexed his very soul and his character. I see Job getting stronger. I really do. Things he says now, later in the book, although it's not a debate because the friends are, they're hushed. They're not going to say anymore. But Job is still speaking. And he addresses some things to them. That's true. But things he says now, he wasn't saying before. And it shows a stronger Job. So, the Lord willing, we'll pick up Wednesday night then with chapter 28. And we're progressing more to the end of Job's speeches. And we'll then talk about Elihu starting in chapter 32. Thank you for your participation today.